About how Paul does not want the Corinthians to sue other believers in the secular Roman courts. He also urged them not to do things that would make other believers want to sue them in the secular Roman courts. And then there's going to be kind of an abrupt topic change in what we're looking at, but there's sort of still a general theme of talking about problematic behaviors that are going on in the Corinthian church that Paul has heard about. So we're going to pick up at 6:12. And the NIV is what I'll be reading from, and it has in quotes, "Everything is permissible for me." And then a dash, and "but not everything is beneficial." And then "everything is permissible for me again, but I will not be mastered by anything." And of course, when Paul wrote this, there weren't quotation marks or dashes, and so figuring out what exactly is going on in this verse has been troubling. The Corinthians would have known much better than us because there's dialogue back and forth between them and Paul, and Paul's getting news, so they know better than we do what's going on in Corinth. I think the translators are right that what Paul is now doing is he's quoting a slogan that's floating around the Corinthian believing community and that he thinks is causing problems. The slogan seems to be something along the lines of "all things are permitted for me." And there's another one that's going to come up in verse 13, "food for the stomach for food, but God will destroy them both." And I think what is happening behind that is that those slogans are being used to justify the fact that believers are free to do whatever they want. And I think it's probably a twisted version of something Paul had taught, perhaps mixed with ideas floating around pagan Greco-Roman thought. So you may be familiar, if you've studied Galatians or Romans, Paul believes that as New Testament Christians, one of the things Jesus has done for us is remove us from the jurisdiction of the law. So Paul, for example, strongly emphasizes to the Galatians, don't put yourselves under the yoke of the law. And it probably is helpful in understanding Paul's argument here to just go look at a couple of those passages. So turn over to Romans 7, for example. So like if you look at Romans 7:4, Paul says, "So my brothers, you also died to the law through the body of Christ that you might belong to another." And so what he's arguing there is that you no longer belong to the jurisdiction of the law. You do belong to a different jurisdiction, which is that of Christ. And so he's going to go on to say, in verse 6, "but now, by dying to what once bound us, we have been released from the law so that we serve in a new way of the Spirit and not in the old way of the written code. So now you answer to Christ through the Holy Spirit. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. Indeed, I would not have known what sin was except through the law." And then he's going to go on to say that even though we believe in grace, we should not sin so that grace should increase. Okay? So you've been set apart from the jurisdiction of the Spirit, but that doesn't mean you get to do whatever you want. So look at Romans 8:12, for example. "Therefore, brothers, we have an obligation, but it is not to the sinful nature to live according to it. For if you live according to the sinful nature, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the misdeeds of the body, you will live." And so Paul did not believe that being removed from the jurisdiction of the law meant anything goes. In fact, I think you could argue the Holy Spirit and Christ have higher standards than the law. That's the whole point of the Sermon on the Mount. Okay? He's going to make a slightly different argument, but what Paul's thoughts on that have always been subject to is other people saying, well, Paul doesn't care about what you do because he says you're not under the jurisdiction of the law. And Paul strongly disagrees with that, but that's a charge opponents have made and tried to twist him. It sounds like that may have been going on in Corinth. The people were twisting that and saying, oh, we're not bound by the law. We're free to do what we want. And the specific topic he's going to get in eventually is going to see prostitutes and participating in prostitution. Where this may have gotten influenced by Greco-Roman thought, too, is that the Roman Empire is kind of this marketplace of wildly competing philosophical ideas. None of them are dominant. One of the strains that's out there is that the body and the material world and the spirit are really distinct. They're two different things. And so some of you may have had to study Plato's cave, for example, which is the idea that everything we see in the material world that we touch and feel is this pale, pathetic reflection of something more ideal that exists somewhere else. And so one of the ideas floating around Greek thought is that your spirit is essentially trapped in this horrible, corrupted meat case, and someday your spirit will be free. And the idea, which was very convenient, that flows from that is, well, then it really doesn't matter what you do with this pathetic, corrupted meat case. And that conveniently leads to, I'm free to do whatever I want in this life because my body does not affect my spirit. And so again, it'd be easy to combine those two things to, well, I can go worship Christ on Sunday and then go to the Temple of Apollos and visit the shrine prostitute there on Monday, and it's okay to take care of my spirit on Sunday and my body on Monday, and no one should have a problem for that because everything is permissible for me. You said I'm not subject to the law anymore. And so Paul pushes back on that in Galatians and Romans by saying, no, 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 you have an obligation to the spirit now. In 1 Corinthians, he's going to push back on it in a different way. So let's go back to 1 Corinthians. So what he pushes back in verse 12 with is not everything is beneficial. And then in the second part, I will not be mastered by anything. Or you could translate that as they're saying, I have liberty to do everything. And Paul saying, but I will not let things take liberty with me. And so Paul is saying, you may be outside the jurisdiction of the law, but that doesn't mean evil things can't affect you. It doesn't mean you can't become addicted to something and it can take over your life. And so even though you're not subject to law anymore, you still need to discern what is good and beneficial to do and what is not. And this idea that everything is beneficial is naive because some things are very much not beneficial for you. Okay? And so he goes on to say, the body is not meant for sexual immorality, and the word there certainly can be translated as sexual immorality. It can also specifically mean prostitution, and you have to look at context to figure out which is meant. It's certainly not a bad translation to go with sexual immorality, because even if what Paul had in mind was prostitution, there are applications to all forms of sexual immorality. So it's not worth fighting about, but we know from verse 15 there's a specific problem with prostitution going on in the Corinthian believing community. And he's saying, your body is not meant for that. Your body is meant for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. So the first point he makes is that you actually worship the Lord with your body, and your body belongs to the Lord. And one of the ways he makes that point is by reminding them of the reality of the resurrection. That also seems to be a problem floating around Corinth, that they've forgotten about the importance of bodily resurrection. He's going to get to that at the end of the epistle. So he reminds them, by his power, God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. So Paul does not, even though you live in a fallen physical body that is going to die, Paul's worldview is that doesn't mean your body's unimportant. In fact, it's so important, God is going to bodily raise you and give you a better, incorruptible, eternal body. And Jesus experienced that. So this whole idea that what you do with your body doesn't matter is wrong. That's a wrong worldview. Paul pushes back on that. Then there's a second, slightly different point, which is, do you not know that your bodies are members or joined with Christ himself? So one argument he's making is based on resurrection, and that means the body is important and you can't dismiss what happens with it. The second thing he's going to argue is connection. And we talked a couple weeks ago about how Paul believes there's a spiritual connection between believers and Christ through the power of the Holy Spirit. And so he earlier talked about them all being members of one temple. So then he argues, well, if that's true, shall I take what is joined to Christ and unite it with a prostitute? And his answer is never, obviously not. Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said, the two will become one flesh. But he who unites himself with the Lord is one with him in spirit. And so here he's combining two arguments that are probably familiar to most Christians, would have been new concepts to a lot of the believers in Corinth. So one of them is the worldview that sex is ordained by God as an inherent part of marriage. It's not something inherently evil, but it is meant to unite a man and a woman in marriage. And so if you go all the way back to Genesis 2, we get the story of Adam and Eve in Genesis 2, and Adam being introduced to Eve as his helpmate. And at the end of that story, Moses interjects, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. And one of the terrible aspects of the fall is that that relationship then becomes subject to all kinds of abuse. But we're still told, even though we're not very good at it anymore, that we are to pursue the goal of marriage as a lifelong relationship between a man and woman. One of the purposes is to produce children. Another purpose of sex is to emotionally and spiritually unite the couple, all right? So in Paul's view, when you have sex, it's not just a physical experience, it is a spiritual one with spiritual and emotional consequences. And so if you are going to see a prostitute, you are messing up the spiritual connection between you and Christ by creating a connection with someone else that's improper and immoral. And so he's also saying that's another problem with it. And don't think that you can do this without having any sort of spiritual or emotional consequences. All right, questions, comments, concerns about those arguments? So this is an example of how your worldview and what you think, how marriage is instituted, what its purpose is, has an impact on what you think is right and wrong. So he says, flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a man commits are outside his body, but he who sins sexually sins against his own body. That's really confusing because Pretty much every sin we do involves our bodies to some extent. For example, Paul's already talked about how the sin of alcoholism, repetitive drunkenness, is something that's an example of a lifestyle that Christians should not have. That clearly involves the body. So what does Paul mean? What is unique about sexual sin? And I think in the context, what's different about it is that when it's done right, sex is supposed to have spiritual and emotional consequences. It's designed to unite you emotionally with someone. So when you're using it improperly, you are harming your ability to connect with Christ in a distinct way. And that makes sexual sin uniquely dangerous in terms of pulling us away from Christ, in terms of being addictive, in terms of having an impact on us. And I think that's what Paul is saying. He's not saying, for example, prostitution is worse than murder or it's more wicked than that. So I don't think we should have classes of believers based on which particular sin we think you've committed. He's not arguing for that. He is arguing in this specific context, you need to flee from this type of sin because you're absolutely wrong. The people in Corinth that are saying it has no consequences for you. All right? Then he finishes that up by saying, do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you? So if you think of the Old Testament temple, and that day, that's where the Israelites went to meet God in a special way. Even though we believe God is not limited by space, they believe he manifested his presence in a special way in the temple. So a temple is a place where God exists and manifests his presence in a special way. Paul is saying, in the New Testament era, that's true of every one of you. God's presence is manifested in a special way in a believer. You're like a walking temple. And so you need to honor God with your body. Something that you wouldn't do in a temple is not something you should do with your body. All right, questions, comments, concerns about that? Okay. Now we're going to switch to a different topic, but some of the worldview and things we talked about in 6 are going to impact what we talk about in 7. So 7 marks a shift in the epistle. He says at 7:1, now for the matters you wrote about. So this is one of the verses that indicates the Corinthians have written a letter to Paul. Paul is answering them. One of the problems that creates for us is the Corinthians know more about what Paul is talking about than we do. So we do some guesstimating of what is the problem Paul is addressing based on context. And so we need to be cautious and careful. So the NIV has, it is good for a man not to marry, and it's not in quotes. If your version is like mine, there's a little letter telling you to look in the margin. And you can see in the margin, in quotes, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, end quote. I think the margin note is actually what seems to be more likely to be going on. And so what Paul seems to be doing is quoting from their letter another idea that's floating around Corinth. And if we read the whole paragraph, it seems to be that some Corinthians were taking this mind-body distinction, spirit-body distinction, and running in the absolute opposite direction, which was, well, if the spirit is so important, then we shouldn't do anything with our body that compromises the spirit. And so even Corinthians who were married to believers were saying, we need to completely abstain from sex in order to be as spiritual as possible. And so it looks like Paul is addressing that thought, and that's the thought encompassed by the quotation, it's good for a man not to have sexual relationships with a woman. You could flip it around, it's good for a woman not to have sexual relations with a man. And Paul is pushing back on that. So Paul says, but since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. And he's not saying there, I'm telling you all you have to get married. What he's saying that if you're married, you need to have sex with your spouse. And one thing he's very careful to do throughout this passage, and you'll notice it, is he makes it gender balanced. And so he here is not arguing that men get to do whatever they want in marriage or that women get to do whatever they want in marriage. It's very much intended to be mutual and consensual. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but to his wife. And so here he's not saying either person in a marriage gets to demand sex from the other whenever they want. Rather, he's saying that is an inherent part of marriage. Each one of you should focus on doing what's beneficial for your spouse, but in no way is he advocating for unconsensual sex. But he is saying it's an inherent, perfectly good part of marriage, so don't treat it as evil. He says, do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time, meaning a limited time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. And there's a whole bunch of back and forth about what does Paul mean by I say this as a concession, not as a command. Is that sentence looking backwards or looking forwards? I was persuaded that if you believe the background that I laid out for you is what's going on, it's looking backwards. And what Paul is saying to the people that were saying they wanted to abstain from sex to be more spiritual, okay, it's okay if you do that for a limited period of time by agreement with your spouse, but I'm saying that as a concession. I'm not telling you you have to do that. But if you want to do some sort of fasting like some people do with food, it is okay under those conditions. Questions, comments, concerns about that? Okay. There's not a lot of this running around in modern America, by the way. Okay? But there's going to be applications that flow from this because it tells us how Paul understands the role of marriage, the view of sex, that have applications to us. Then he goes on to say, I wish that all men were as I am. And the Corinthians would know what he meant because they had met him. We don't know. But each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. So what we think is going on is that if you believe the background is accurate, the people that were advocating that you could be more spiritual by avoiding sex, even if you were married, were citing Paul as evidence of that. Paul is not married, he's celibate, therefore that means any super Christian should be the same way. And Paul is saying that he doesn't want that state to be a law that everyone tries to obtain. On the other hand, Paul is going to talk in the rest of this chapter about how he thinks it's great if you can be content in that state and focus on your life on ministry for the Lord. He thinks that has eternal significance. So he's kind of trying to navigate very carefully between a couple of extremes. And what he's saying here is that if you could be celibate, that would be great, but each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. And he's saying not everyone can be that way. And if you're married, the dice is already cast, and you shouldn't. His general theme in this chapter, his overall theme, is to be content with the state that you're in, the social status that you're in. And so if you're already married, that die is cast. You've got a spouse you got to be concerned about, that you've got to take care of, and so your goal should not be to be like Paul in this particular area. And so Paul is saying, yeah, that would be nice, but don't use me as an example to support married people abstaining from sex. Questions, comments, concerns about that? Yeah. Yep. Yeah, Paul is recognizing the reality that the desire for sex is a great way for Satan to tempt people to sin. And so he's basically saying that you will be tempted to do things like prostitution if you're not expressing sex healthy in marriage. So not having a sex life in marriage makes you vulnerable to other sexual sins. Paul's acknowledging that reality. Any other questions?
You had talked about last week, I think, the God's gift of sex is childbearing, right? Not necessarily recreational, but maybe. Right, but there's this human need.
I don't think the Bible would support recreational, but I think childbearing's not the only purpose. I think emotional intimacy is. And so I think if you, like, let's use the Tinder lifestyle as an example. If you are pursuing encounters where you intend to have sex with someone and have no relationship with them, then I think you're avoiding both the childbearing and the emotional intimacy aspect that sex is supposed to have. So I do think there's more to it than just having kids. But keep going. I think I cut you off.
Yeah, no, it's just thinking about categorically what the gift of sex is for. Right?
Yes.
And I think that intimacy, as you say, is a huge component, setting aside the importance of Christians bearing children.
Right. And, I think what Paul would say is, when you think about not participating in prostitution, you also need to think about what prostitution is doing to the prostitute. And, that is a terrible lifestyle to be doing this thing that was meant to connect you with one other person for money over and over and over again, whether you really want to do it or not. I mean, that has to be horribly damaging to the spirit and soul of the person who's in that. And probably not because they wanted to go into it, but they felt like they had no other choice but to survive that way, especially in the first century. And you could say the same thing about some of the things that are going on in America, where if you are pursuing this series of casual relationships with no intent to connect with the person, you're using your soul and spirit in a way it wasn't designed, just like using a car in a way it wasn't designed. And I think Paul would say you're doing damage to yourself, you're doing damage to the other person. And if you think someday you're simply going to be able to flip a switch and have a healthy marriage, you're probably kidding yourself. So, what we were designed for, I think, matters. And what Paul was trying to get the Corinthians to believe was not something that would have been part of their worldview as Romans. And so it's a culture shift for the people he's writing to as much as it is for us. Anything else before we move on? Okay. So now there's another translation problem. The NIV has "now to the unmarried and the widows, I say." Some versions will have as a margin note, "to the widowers and widows, I say." I think that widower is what's intended here. Part of the reason for that is that he is going to address single people later in the chapter. And unmarried would obviously include single people and widows. So it'd be kind of weird to say unmarried and widows when widows are a subpart of the unmarried. It also would be weird to have this little verse here and then this big chunk of topic about unmarried people later in the chapter. So this would be a common situation in the Roman Empire. One thing that is different for us as Americans than them is the death rate. So one of the statistics I saw while I was studying for this is that in the Roman Empire, 50% of people died before they were 10. So imagine the impact that would have on your outlook as a family if you expect half your kids are not going to make it to 10. And then if you make it to 10 in the Roman Empire, half the people are not going to make it to 50. So I was 10 in the fourth grade. Imagine half your fourth grade class being gone before you're 50. And the way we think that worked out numbers-wise was the average life expectancy in the Roman Empire was 30 to 35 years. But keep in mind, that's an average. It's not like people were incapable of living to 80 or 90. It was just the odds were that something was going to end your life unnaturally. For men, there were all kinds of things. You know, disease got everybody back then. Male or female. For men, you're doing these dangerous, back-breaking occupations, including being drafted to serve in the Roman army. So there are all sorts of ways you can die. For women, childbirth is wiping out huge numbers of women. It's a dangerous thing to do. And so if you're a Roman, and the prevailing thought in the Roman Empire is not that you have this eternal soul that's going to have this nice afterlife, they're very ambivalent and don't know what's going to happen after death. Some of them have this vague hope something good happens to your spirit. Others think that's the end. And so there's this huge pressure in Roman society that you will get married, you will get married young, you will have kids. Your kids are your legacy. So they're not thinking I'm eternal. They're thinking of what can I leave my kids to carry on for me. So there's huge pressure in Roman society to marry, to have at least three kids. And if your spouse dies, you try and remarry as quick as possible, usually within less than a year, so that you can have heirs. Another purpose of marriage is if you don't have much of a sense of an afterlife, you're very focused on climbing the social ladder while you can in this life, and marriage in the Roman Empire is one of the big ways to get up to the next rung. And so they're using marriages to link families and form alliances, because families who you trust, you don't really trust anyone else, and they want to build as big of a family network as they can. So there's this intense societal pressure. If you're a widow or a widower, you need to get remarried. You need to continue the project of building the family. And Paul pushes back on that and says, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I am. And so Paul says, you don't need to rush into remarriage. Being single is perfectly fine for widows and widowers. That is an absolutely valid choice. So that's a way he's countercultural to the first century. But then he acknowledges, if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry, and what it literally says, as to burn or be in flames. And so there's a big debate, well, what does Paul mean by burn or be in flames? And on one side, you have the people that are saying, well, he's saying that if you feel like you can't withstand sexual temptation, then get married so you can have a healthy, permissible sex life. There are others that say, no, he's saying get married so you don't burn in hell. And there's a third possibility, which is this is wordplay, and Paul is thinking of both, and that he's making a bit of a pun by burn. I don't know. It certainly seems possible that he's got both thoughts in mind, but the point is you've got two valid things. You can stay single if you can be like Paul, or you're welcome to get married. Either one, valid choice. Questions, comments, concerns about that? So the thought would be that if you cannot avoid a lifestyle of immorality, Paul's thought is your lifestyle tells you what you believe. If you have a lifestyle of going to prostitutes and immorality, that indicates you don't really believe you're in danger of burning in hell. So it is a train of thought. Good question. All right. Let's keep going. Then he talks to the married, and there seems to be another odd problem related to the one we've already talked about. I give this command, not I, but the Lord. And that little not I, but the Lord is really confusing. What I thought was the best explanation of what's going on here is that what he means is that what he is trying to say he believes is consistent with what Jesus taught in his ministry during the gospel. So Jesus spoke on the subject of divorce and marriage publicly during his ministry. One thing to keep in mind is that Paul is probably writing 1 Corinthians before any of the gospels are written. So Paul doesn't mean what I'm saying is consistent with Matthew 19, because Matthew 19 probably isn't written. But Paul may have actually heard some of what Jesus taught in Jerusalem. Certainly after Paul encountered Jesus on the way to Damascus and decides he wants to follow Christ, he would have tried to find out everything that Jesus said. So even before the Gospels get written, you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, Peter walking around sharing what Jesus has taught. And so there is an understanding of Jesus' teaching that existed among the apostles, including Paul, even before the Gospels are written. And so what he's saying is, what I'm about to say is consistent with what Jesus said. He's then going to get to a passage where he's going to say, this is from me, not Jesus, meaning I'm now going to tell you something that Jesus didn't say during his gospel ministry. For those of us who believe in inspiration, the Holy Spirit's behind it all, so it's not like the next section is less worthy of being in the Bible than this section. Paul's just signaling one is based on what Jesus actually said, one is based on what he believes he's gleaned from the Holy Spirit. Questions, comments, concerns about that before we move on? Okay. All right, let's keep going. So he says, I give this command to married people. So, and he's specifically talking here from the context to people who are married to another believer. He says, a wife must not separate from her husband. And by separate, he means divorce. And here to kind of track why Paul says separate, not divorce, it helps to understand how Roman marriages work. So, Roman marriages are different than ours. Like, if you want to get married in the United States, you need a marriage license from the state. So marriage is a civil, state-recognized institution in America. Many people also want to get married in a church, right? If you're Roman, neither of those things probably apply to you. You aren't getting married at the Temple of Zeus, nor are you going to a courthouse. There's no record keeping of who's married to who by the Roman government. In Roman society, it's basically a private agreement between you and the person you want to marry and their families. And there's no documentation. And so how do we know Joe and Sally are married? They say they want to be married and they live together. So if you want a divorce as a Roman, you just move out. And you say, I don't want to be married anymore. And you are divorced. And so when Paul says a wife must not separate from her husband, he's saying a wife must not divorce her husband by moving out, in essence. And interestingly, like so many things with the Romans, they're very practical and pragmatic and not romantic about marriage. And so they have nothing against a lifelong marriage. And they'll even, you can find inscriptions on tombs that talk about people who were married for their life, and they think that's a good thing. But they also believe marriage is for the purpose of elevating your family. It's for financial security. And so if it isn't doing those things for you, there's no real stigma to divorcing this person and moving on to someone you think is going to help you with those things. And so this is another area where Paul is being countercultural. One thing that's different, if you're familiar with Jewish background from the Gospels, is the Roman view of marriage and divorce is a little less one-sided than the first century Jewish view. So like in the Gospels, Jesus is speaking in a context where it was believed that a guy could divorce a woman and marry someone else whenever he felt like it, for any reason he felt like it, by simply handing the woman a certificate that said, "We're divorced," and send her away. The Roman is a little bit more even-handed. So a woman could theoretically leave as easily as a man could. In practical reasons, she's probably more limited by economic realities than guys are. So this is still a chauvinistic society in Rome for the first century, but not quite so much. And what looks like, because Paul refers to the wife separating, and this goes back to the problem we talked about at the beginning of the chapter, is that some of these women who are taking the view that abstaining from sex made them more spiritual were even leaving a marriage to do that. And Paul is saying, don't do that. You don't have the right to divorce a believing husband for this reason that's misguided anyway. He's going to, at the end of the paragraph, make this applicable to the guys too, so the guys aren't getting a pass. But then he acknowledges a reality, which is that some women are divorced. So he says, but if she does, so in other words, if she has already divorced, when you hear this, she has two options. She must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And so again, if she's already divorced, Paul is not uncomfortable with her remaining in that status. He presents that as a legitimate option for her, which might surprise some of us, especially if you have a Roman Catholic background. And then he offers a second alternative, which is to be reconciled to your husband. One thing that I think is important here is not to grab this ball and run with it and make universal laws, because there are all sorts of parameters, different situations and circumstances that could affect this. For example, I think Paul would say, if your ex-spouse dies, obviously you can't reconcile with them. I think Paul, he doesn't talk about it because that's not the problem he's working with. I think he would probably acknowledge that is a game changer. I think if your spouse marries someone else, that makes it impossible to properly reconcile with them. So that is a game changer. So there are lots of scenarios Paul isn't trying to cover. And so we need to be careful about taking what he says too far. But his main point is that I don't want believers to divorce because they think that they're being more spiritual by doing that. But if you do find yourself divorced, it is legitimate to remain unmarried, which, by the way, the average Roman who got divorced, we think, got remarried within 6 months. So again, another countercultural thing he's saying is totally okay to stay single or else be reconciled. And a husband must not divorce his wife. So the same rules apply to husbands. But keep in mind, there are lots of scenarios that affect divorce and remarriage that aren't covered here. We're going to get to another one in just another second. All right. Yeah, in the back.
Do you know, just out of curiosity, what happened with kids? Like, it was so common to divorce and remarry. Like, did men keep kids? Did women keep kids? What happened?
That is a great question, and I don't really know. So who got to keep the kids? And, you know, the answer is probably, well, who could provide for them? And adoption's pretty common in the Roman Empire, in part because so many people are dying all over the place. My guess would be most likely the husband got to decide that. So it probably broke the way the husband wanted. And you probably could not go to a magistrate and ask for a decision like we can here.
Something you mentioned on the front end, you're talking more on the back end. Today's culture here has a certificate essentially saying we're married, but there is also common law, right? Is that something that you think if you decided ahead of time, sort of spiritually, you might say, that you're going to live in this goal to get to a point that would be legitimate for God, or is that sort of...
I think that's a really good question. I'm not sure what the answer, if anyone's listening to the recording, the question is, well, what if you had the intent to have a lifelong monogamous relationship, but you didn't bother to get the legal document that says you're married? I think you can certainly make an argument that the spiritual connection is more important than the legal one to God. And that's actually where the Roman Catholic Church goes in explaining what Paul is going to say next. And so we'll come back to that thought. And then you get into the whole argument of the appearance of impropriety. And I think reasonable minds, reasonable Christian minds, can disagree over how far to carry that principle. So I think one argument a lot of people would make is, well, it appears you're doing exactly what a pagan would do. That's a bad testimony for Christ. But I also think there's a point when you have to do what you think is right and tell the world to go jump in a lake. And Christians can disagree on the line between those things. So I think that's difficult to answer, and Christians could answer it in different ways. But I think, for sure, the spiritual relationship and the commitment between the man and woman is more important than the document or the legality.
Does South Dakota still have a common law marriage?
So I think we do. You almost never run into it anymore. And so, you know, that almost every state at one time recognized common law marriage. And the last I checked, it still exists. And it is, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the way it works in our statute is if you have lived together for at least 7 years holding yourself out as man and wife, that is as good as getting a document. The problem you subject yourself to, and where this usually comes up to, is when one of the people dies, and now we have a fight about who gets their stuff, is you've made yourself vulnerable to the argument that, oh, well, they weren't really living as man and wife, and so you could have a fight. Your status legally is less clear if you care about property rights that come with marriage. But I think it still exists. And that was because there was a time when we didn't have a courthouse available for everybody. So, I mean, that I think the commitment between the man and woman really is what's more important.
Just for the record,
in Minnehaha County? Yeah, good times. Good call. All right. Okay. So now let's complicate things even further. So to the rest, I say this, I not the Lord. So this is the part where I think he's going beyond what Jesus taught in the Gospels. Like everything he said in the previous paragraph, I think very consistent with what Jesus says in the Gospels. This is a topic that I don't think Jesus addressed. If any brother, meaning a believer, has a wife who's not a believer, and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. So mixed marriages, not discussed in the gospel. Religiously mixed marriages. And if a woman, meaning a believing woman, has a husband who's not a believer, and he, the unbeliever, is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. So in other words, the mere fact that you have become a Christian is not a basis to divorce your unbelieving spouse. Paul's going to later say that's not something you should go into. So he's going to say don't be unequally yoked, meaning being on the same spiritual wavelength is very important for a successful marriage. So don't look for this situation. But again, if you find yourself in it, that in itself is not a basis for divorce. But he kind of puts the ball in the unbeliever's court. But first he addresses a weird argument that we as Americans probably wouldn't think of. He says, for the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. So this would be an example of why you have to be careful about grabbing the ball and running with it when Paul discusses a specific case. Like, if you think back to what we talked about at the beginning of the hour and the implications of having sex with a prostitute, and Paul seems to say that would defile you, you could logically then infer, well, the same thing would happen if you have sex with an unbelieving spouse. Oh my gosh, I am defiled. I'm unclean. Especially from a Jewish background, that kind of thought process might make sense. And Paul is saying, even though that's logical, it's different. And so you don't need to worry about that. And so the fact that you've now converted is not a basis for you to divorce your unbelieving spouse. So then we run into people that worry and say, oh, so is he saying that a conversion of one spouse is enough to save the other spouse? Because he does use the words holy and sanctified. But if you look down to verse 16, he's going to go on and say, how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Indicating that their status as a believer is still up for grabs, and they may never become a believer. So whatever he means by holy and sanctified in verse 14, he's not saying they're saved just because you got saved. They're a Christian just because you became a Christian. So what I think he's going back to is sort of the Old Testament concept of being set apart for a task. And so, for example, in the temple, you could take a ladle and you could ceremonially cleanse it and then set it apart to be used in the temple instead of your house or the local bar. And that ladle would be holy in the sense that it's set apart for God. And so he is saying the unbelieving spouse has been cleansed in that fashion. It is no longer something that would defile the believing spouse by having contact. And we do see one example of an unbeliever who gets used for sacred purposes in the Old Testament is Cyrus, the Persian king. In Isaiah, God talks about how I've picked out Cyrus and I'm using him for the purpose of delivering the Israelites from the Babylonian yoke. And so God can take things, including people, that don't even believe in him and use them for his purposes. And so there's something different. So then we need to think about, well, what makes this different? And I think it goes back to the importance of the institution of marriage. Marriage is a divinely instituted thing that God created and designed humans for. And so it has a powerful impact. And so even though this is religiously mixed marriage, it doesn't defile you by being part of it. I think it's part because God has designed you for that role. All right, questions, comments, concerns about that? All right, so let's keep going and finish this up, and then we'll be done. So, but if the unbeliever leaves, let him do so. So the ball is in the unbeliever's court once one of the spouses converts. And if the person takes the point of view that, hey, I didn't sign up to be married to a Christian, I don't want to be married to a Christian, Paul says, do not fight them, let them go. So don't break the peace or create unnecessary conflict. I don't think that means you can't ask them to stay, but if they say, no, I've heard your argument and I want out, you're to let them out. And here's the big controversial thing. He says, a believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances. And so there is a debate about how far to take this. How many of you grew up in the Roman Catholic Church? We usually have a few. Okay, so how many of you have heard of something called the Pauline privilege? Anyone? Okay, so here's the controversy. You know, the Roman Catholic Church is as strict on divorce and remarriage as any institution, and they've held that line for centuries, right? But they have recognized the view that what this means is that if an unbeliever leaves a believing spouse, you are free to remarry. So you are released from the bounds of marriage in that situation, and it's called the Pauline privilege. And the Roman Catholics have this thing called canon law that, I mean, is crazy developed and detailed. And so this is set forth in canon law, and there's this huge logical step. And the way they get there is they say, if you think about it, marriage is really a spiritual connection between the man and the woman. And in their view, it's a sacrament, and it's supposed to be a sacrament when both are believers. So what they say is that if neither one of you were a Christian when you got married, you didn't have a sacramental marriage. You had a janky little secular marriage. And so if the unbeliever leaves, you haven't broken a sacrament and you're not bound to him. And so if you go to the priest and say that, even though it was legally recognized as in a marriage, we can in effect annul it and recognize that you weren't really married, therefore you weren't really divorced in the way we're concerned about, and so you are free to remarry. And there's a whole series of steps where you can get that recognized by the Catholic Church. Then there are other comments, and Luther agreed with that, by the way. Then there are other commentators that say, no, Paul doesn't, he's not even thinking about remarriage at this point, so that's not what he means. After reading it, I actually thought the Catholics got it right on this one. I think that is what Paul means when he says you're not bound by the marriage. But it is controversial. That raises a whole can of worms. We as humans don't have 100% knowledge who's a believer and who's not. So as a pastor and as a person, as you think about, well, what is Paul saying I should do in my current status? You have to think that through, and when is it appropriate to treat someone who professes they're a believer as though not a believer? Lots of tricky questions. And one of the things I think it should teach us as a church is that one way you can go off the rails, I think, is by saying divorce for everybody. Divorce doesn't matter and doesn't have any consequences. And I think, well, obviously that would be wrong. And so we don't want churches to be saying, give up on marriage easily. It's not a big deal. It is a big deal. Even secular people would tell you that. It's a financial disaster. It's rough on kids. I mean, the ideal would be that both parties are able to work things out. But we're fallen people. The ideal doesn't always happen. And so you also need to realize there is grace for people who go through divorce for all sorts of different reasons. And we shouldn't take the view that divorce and remarriage is like this video game. And if you haven't been divorced, you've made it to level 10. And if you had been divorced, you're stuck on level 5. And you'll never be a level 10 character. You'll never be as good as them. You'll never be as spiritual as them. I mean, that sort of attitude existed in the past in Anglo-American culture. I think that's unbiblical too. There's grace for everybody. We don't know why people get divorced usually. Usually there's things that happen inside the marriage no one else knows about. So we need to be very cautious in how we view divorced people, and we shouldn't make assumptions about why they got divorced. And so this is really tricky and presents complex pastoral problems. And while all of us should be striving for the ideal, we need to be giving each other grace in these areas. The reason Paul's talking about them is because they're hard. And so we need to encourage each other to strive for the ideal, but we need to recognize none of us are perfect, and so we also need to be a community that gives each other grace, and we need to recognize that's not going to be easy, but we need to muddle through it. All right. I think I used up all the time. Thanks.